From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. Welcome to The Treatment. My guest, Kevin Bacon, after a significant and ongoing career as an actor, is returning to the other side of the camera. He made Losing Chase a few years ago. His new film as a director is Loverboy, an adaptation of a really interesting novel. Kevin, thanks for coming by, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
Talk about what attracted you to doing such a tricky book as Loverboy.
Well, I enjoy films sometimes that are kind of nonlinear, and when I read the book, it was told sort of in this flashback, and you had this way of kind of putting the pieces together of this personal kind of mystery. And I got a sense from the beginning of the book that there was something kind of tragic that was happening, but the process by which it unfolded to me seemed kind of interesting from a cinematic standpoint. It was a funny kind of situation because my wife, Kira, shops. And one of the places she shops is a little store on the Upper West Side called CPW. And she had become friendly with Linda Wolf, who was the owner of the shop. And Linda said, you know, I got this book. It was written by a friend of mine. And I think it would be a great book for you to act in and for Kevin to direct. And, you know, in the course of your life, people tend to say those things quite a bit, you know. And oftentimes it turns out not to be true. And Kira read the book and she said, I think you ought to take a look at this one, and I read it, and I just thought it would make it a really cool movie.
Are you talking about your wife, Kira Sedgwick, who was also in Losing Chase? After you read the book, and it really is this sort of thing that comes from an unreliable narrator, you should describe a little bit for the audience what the book's about.
We meet a woman who has one real obsession in her life, and that is to have a child. She needs the man only to the extent that she has to have somebody impregnate her, but she really doesn't – she's not interested in having a man in her life. She wants to create a kind of utopian existence in this kind of magical world between her and a child. And she is – in the beginning of the film, we see her on that journey, and eventually she does have a child, and you – it kind of looks like the perfect mother-son relationship. And in the course of the film, you start to see both through flashback and also through her actions that she's kind of unraveling and that she is a sort of, you know, definitely a disturbed and kind of emotionally unstable person, based a lot on some issues that she had as a child and relationships with her own parents. And the book and the film have sort of tragic consequences.
And Kira's in the lead. She plays this person you're talking about. I guess one of the things that's interesting to me about the movie is that it's not nearly sort of as grim as the book. And then was that a conscious decision for you?
Yeah, it was. You know, it's funny because when it comes time, you know, you make the movies and then it comes time to talk about them. And often when I'm describing the movie, I try to point that out only because while I think there is a place for darkness in films, God knows I've gone there, you know, plenty of times. I didn't want to make what is traditionally thought of as a dark movie. I wanted the movie to have magic and romance and be sexy and funny, and I just wanted to sort of layer it in that way.
It's a treat. We're talking to this time director Kevin Bacon about his new film Loverboy. I guess you've got to deal with this thing too that you've got to make the book into a movie, and you can't necessarily take everything, you and your screenwriter, that makes the book work and make that work as a movie anyway, can you?
No, you can't. The one thing that I did, I mean, I met with a few writers, and the book is told a lot with kind of flashbacks and scenes, and it jumps around in time an awful lot. And one woman that I talked to about writing it said, well, let's not do that. Let's just make it. Let's just start the story in the beginning, have the story end at the end. And I knew that that would be, for me, a little bit too much of a departure from the book. So while the film does depart from the book in a lot of ways, I did want to keep this idea of flashbacks and flashbacks within flashbacks, because a lot of it deals a lot with the nature of memory. And the way that we remember things is not always the way that they were, and the way that we could have had a shared experience, you and you would remember it differently than I would. Sometimes memories are lush, and sometimes they're stark, and sometimes they have a musical score, and you know, sometimes they're silent. So this is a story that's told by the lead character, and in her mind, there's nothing that she's doing or has done that is wrong. So to tell it as this kind of very, very grim sort of tale, I felt would be wrong for the film.
I'm wondering if for you, The World According to Garp was any kind of influence at all, because it felt to me like it was very much an influence on that book.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I never really, I guess I didn't consciously think of it, but it is one of my favorite books. The telling of that story and the way that he brings a lot of humor into these very kind of tragic situations, I think, are very kind of profound. And I'm sure that subconsciously it was an influence on me.
The movie feels a lot more like that book, actually, than the movie of The World According to Garp did. You know, the way that it's almost this kind of suburban magic realism to it.
Mm-hmm.
The way that an American would do that. And I just wonder if you found that there were parts of things, other movies, other books that you were bringing into this as you were starting to make it.
Well, I don't really think of other movies when I'm directing. I love movies and I look at them and I enjoy them. I'm sure that in some, you know, obviously camera techniques and directorial techniques and the great directors that I've had an opportunity to work with all, you know, fill me up and influence me in different ways. But rarely do I actually go to work and say, you know, I really want to do a scene, you know, like The Godfather or something like that. You know, I mean, it doesn't come into play for me.
In this movie, obviously, as compared to Losing Chase, you're a lot more confident as a filmmaker. I mean, that was kind of a lot of master shots and just letting the – and still both movies are about sort of the emotional life of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me to be more important to you, or at least as important as the narrative part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But as a filmmaker, I feel like you've got a lot more sort of bravura, more confidence than you did the first time around.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little wacky, the movie, you know. I'm totally to blame for that. But when I set out to be an actor, I never really considered being a director. I thought that the process of filmmaking was so overwhelming that all I wanted to do was just do my little piece of the project, you know, hit the mark and say the line and, you know, do my thing and then be okay. You know, as more time I spent on sets, the more time I started to become fascinated with all the elements that go into it.
What was the first time you were really conscious of that, thinking, I want to know how this works, or paying attention to those things?
Well, probably from the first day the very first Animal House was the first movie I did, and the first day that I walked on the set and said lines, I was like, you know, I can't believe what a madhouse this is. The second day, I started to look around a little bit more, you know. The third day, I started to notice what other people's jobs were. You know, I wasn't just, you know, completely focused on my own thing, although I was tried to be focused. And it's just been a process over the years of becoming so comfortable with what the day in the life of a movie is that eventually you sort of say to yourself, well, let me try to tell the story. And how can I tell the story? How can I tell the story with lenses? How can I tell the story with filters and blocking and casting and costume and set design and music and all those things. And that really is what it comes down to. If you have a story, for me, if you have a story that you want to tell, you start to think directorially. You know, I don't always read a script as an actor, for instance, and start to get directing ideas. I kind of wait for the piece of material that I read that makes me think as a director, and then I think to myself, okay, that's something that maybe I would like to put my mark on.
Is that why you waited so long to direct another movie?
Yeah, I did wait a long time. It was that. It was also there's a lot going on in life between my acting life and my wife's career and my children and my band. And, you know, I mean, to find the time to – and as you know, I mean, I'm a director who at this point in my career is working in a very, very kind of independent, if we could call it off Broadway kind of way. It takes a big chunk of time and a big kind of commitment both between, you know, especially if you're developing a piece of material to get it done and to raise the money and post-production and stuff. And I haven't just in my life been able to find the time to carve out and also just finding the story.
We're talking to Kevin Bacon, who's a director again for the second time, a scant 8 years after his first film. Mm-hmm. We're talking about his new film, Loverboy. I guess I'm thinking when I see a movie like this, you wanted to choose a second film that was a bit more ambitious for you than your first was.
Yes, definitely. And I think that, you know, the nature of the material is a little bit more complex. And also,
it seems like it's a lot more complex, actually, because you're doing – in sort of structural terms, the same thing the book is, just making us sort of think that we like her at first.
Right.
But it's more about understanding her finally than liking her.
Yes.
So it seems like it's a – maybe you don't want to say this, but it's a really big sort of leap to make.
Well, you know, I guess I don't even think about how big a leap it is. I mean, the one thing I do know is that both of the films are films that involve women. Both of them involve a certain kind of insanity.
And the insanity that's not immediately apparent.
Not immediately apparent, yeah. I would say that chances are those are two themes that I'd rather not deal with next time. You know, I'd like to do a movie for guys, about guys, or something that's just a little bit more, you know, male-driven. They were both projects that were obviously for Kira to act in, and I love working with her. She's the best actress I know, and it's always a pleasure. I think I am looking the next time I direct to do something that is possibly a little different. And I also think that it would be nice to be a little schizophrenic in terms of, you know, the kinds of movies that I direct. There are directors who do, you know, similar kinds of things time and time again. And you know, as an actor, I think that I've tried to switch things up as much as possible. And I think I'd probably like to do that as a director as well.
As you mentioned, it seems like there's this time, and I think it goes specifically back to The River Wild, which sort of like started a whole new kind of career for you when you start doing more things to really sort of break people out of thinking of you in a certain kind of way. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about too. As a director, you don't want to get pigeonholed.
I don't. I'd like to do something funny, or I'd like to do something, you know, that's...
You mean like a straight-out comedy song?
Straight-out comedy, or something that was, you know, action-based Of course, I'd love to make a movie that a bazillion people would see, but chances are, just because of my own sensibility, it'll be something that's a little bit off.
I was going to say, based on your orientation, even towards the mainstream stuff you do, it tends to be not the center of the bullseye anyway.
Right.
And I would imagine that's kind of what attracts you as a director, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Does that feel like, even as you were reading the book, you saw a movie in it? Because I have to admit, in reading that book, I didn't quite see where the movie was.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I saw shots, I heard music, I thought of casting. All those things started to fall into my mind the first from page one. And then the second time I read the book, you know, even more so, I started thinking about ways that we could, you know, work structurally. And then, of course, once the script is done, you kind of have to put the book aside in a way and work off of your new form, you know, which is the script. And then once the movie's done, you kind of have to throw the script away. Because of the nature of the film, there's a lot of scenes that are sort of out of place and flashbacks and different periods in this woman's life that you see, and the child is different ages. And we would kind of color code these scenes and give them a name and thumbtack them up on this big wall. And it was really, really interesting to take things and move them into places that I'd never imagined they would be. So that one scene that was not in the script to blend into the next or to cut to the next would now be shifted around. And it's one of the amazing parts of editing. Of course, in a movie that is nonlinear, you don't have the problem of saying, well, this guy's he can't be five here and seven and here, and then go back to five. In my movie, he can be. You know, so it was really, really kind of a fascinating process doing that.
We'll take a break. We're talking to Kevin Bacon, director this time around of Lover Boy. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is director Kevin Bacon. You may have heard of him as an actor. He's done a few things. This is the second film we're talking about, Loverboy. I have to ask you, because you've worked with Barry Levinson a couple of times, and I've talked to you since you worked with Clint Eastwood, and you talked about what a kind of amazing sort of organized civil set that was. I wonder what influence both those guys, specifically Eastwood, has on you as a director, because you worked on his movie since having directed your first film.
Well, yeah. I mean, in fact, while I was doing Mystic River, I was really trying to turn the burner up on getting Loverboy to do, because I was so impressed with the way that Clint directed and the feeling and the vibe on the set that it made me want to get back in the saddle again. You know, it really, I wanted to try to use some of his technique, some of his...
How would you describe that technique?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it is incredibly well-organized, which, of course, I was not. I can tell you what his technique is, and I'll tell you, you know, what I was able to accomplish. He's very, very calm, which I was not. He creates a place wherein the actors can come to do their best work. And in that way, I think I took a lot away from that. I know that for me, when I first became an actor, I sort of had this idea that a director was the guy who was going to come up and in between take one and take two, whisper some brilliant little gem into your ear, and you were going to become, you know, Olivier in between take one and take two. And it just is not the case. I can count on, you know, one hand the amount of times that someone has actually given me, and this is not hubris, but he's given me that choice piece of direction that has turned me into a better actor. Generally, I think a good director creates a place where good actors can come, and he gives them the respect and the space to come and do their work. And he gives them, most importantly, the support and the encouragement that actors need. Because we are, you know, like everybody else, insecure and
that level of calm adds to that, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Because, you know, when you walk onto a set and the director seems so in control, and when he tells everybody to be quiet and let you do your work, it fills you up with the confidence just to hit it out of the park on take two or take three. You know, I mean, he's very supportive. He's not a critic. Okay, you know that he's not critical of you. There's a difference between being saying I didn't like that, I didn't like what you did, and saying that's great where you're going. Can we go even farther or continue on down this path? And of course, that's the fun thing in terms of working with the great actors that I had in the movie. Obviously, Kira Sedgwick, Marissa Tomei, Campbell Scott, Oliver Platt, and Sandra Bullock, and
your kids,
Matt Dillon. Yeah, my kids. I just kind of would try to create a place where they could work and sit back and just let them do their work. You know,
it's the treatment. We're talking to Kevin Bacon about his second directing. His film is Loverboy. I wonder if you feel that the thing that Truffaut said is true—that 90% of directing is casting.
I think it's huge, and I think that it's also very, very difficult, because if we could just put in the person, the actor, that we really just thought was best for the role, it would make it a lot easier. But that's not the case at any level.
How do you mean?
Well, we have a movie that is, you know, made for a song, and yet the financiers still want names, and they still want people who have what they consider to be box office clout. And that's in a small independent kind of situation. When you get into studio pictures, I mean, it's crazy. And I don't care who you are as a director. I'm talking about the biggest directors in the world. They can set up a movie and they won't necessarily have the power to make the best choice in terms of someone who has the acting ability or is the right person to play the part. It's so much more driven by movie stars. I mean, that's really what a lot of what our industry is now. So sometimes your hands are tied in terms of casting. But I think that it is very, very important, and it's also very, very important in terms of the smaller roles as well. I think that a lot of times, I mean, you know, you see a picture, and you know, the lead is whatever, good, and then you're watching some of the day playing, and it's just not really working. You know, if you look at Mystic River, there's a bunch of guys in that movie that you maybe have never seen before and maybe never will see again. And somehow, between Clint and Phyllis Huffman, who was a great casting director who also cast Loverboy, thankfully, recently tragically died. But the two of them were able to really find great, great, you know, guys who would come in and have three lines. And it really adds to the fabric and the whole feel of a movie. It's very, very important.
I know you worked with Talking about this, you remind me you've worked with Barry Levinson at two different stages of his career. At the beginning, where it definitely wasn't about movie stars and Diner, but the right actors for the right roles. And then a few years later, when you work with him again, it was a much different kind of circumstance, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, then we did Sleepers and Brad Pitt and Jason Patrick and Dustin Hoffman.
And it's also a studio movie, too.
Yeah, studio movie, yeah. So that is a situation where they had to fill out that cast with the people who were, you know, the names, and it, you know, makes a good poster.
Yeah, but for me, it feels like a movie where the casting works so well, it's so organic. And in the case of a movie like Diner, you must have really felt like that thing you were talking about that you felt years later with Clint Eastwood, that confidence in him picking you guys when you guys sort of work together and start to cook really comes out in the filmmaking and in the acting too.
Well, it's interesting that you point that out because, you know, there's a lot of talk about ensemble films. People use this word ensemble a lot. And it's been very, very few times in my acting career, that I've actually felt like I was part of an ensemble. I find movie making often to be a very kind of isolating sort of medium, much more so than the theater. You know, you can be in an ensemble, but oftentimes somebody's trailer is bigger than somebody else's and someone's getting more money or someone has more screen time or just already a bigger name or, you know, it's, again, it goes back to this kind of star-driven, you know, industry that we're in at this point. But Diner really did feel like an ensemble. We really felt like we were all a bunch of guys down in Baltimore hanging out, doing this movie, and let's see what happens, you know. Mystic River also had very much of that feel, and I think it kind of trickles down from the top with Clint. I mean, he is, you know, since he is arguably the biggest star, you know, in the world.
And still had to fight to get Mystic River done.
Still had to fight to get it done, yeah. He has little tolerance for any kind of hierarchy based on fame or stardom or any of those things. He just doesn't play that way, you know. It's just like you're there, you're one of the guys, you all got the same size hotel room, you all got the same size trailer, you're all getting the same deal, and you know, let's just get together and make the movie. And we really had a great time in that way. I also to mention Diner again, it's interesting because I think to myself now, if somebody was making Diner nowadays, I think there would be a lot of pressure to search out, you know, someone who was hot from a TV show, or you know, to put a movie together now with five, you know, or six guys in their early 20s, you would be finding a lot of people saying, "Well, what magazine cover has he been on? And you know, what show? Does he have a movie coming out that's going to make him hot?" You know, those are the types of things. Those are the ways that people put casts together now. Back in those days, with a movie at that budget level, it wasn't so much an issue. Barry Levinson went and had auditions. He had auditions in L.A. and he had auditions in New York. He had screen tests and he just picked guys, unknown guys, just whoever, you know. Just if that guy's right for the part and he seems to work in this group, you know, he's got the gig.
It's the treatment. We're talking to Kevin Bacon about his new film as a director, Loverboy. One of the things that sort of struck me, too, about your work, especially in the last 10 years, is that the movies have gone to being a lot more intimate, you know, much more sort of smaller scale but bigger emotional scale. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's, too, something that's kind of inspiring you as a director, that you feel like those are the stories you want to tell because, I mean, a lot of the big studio stuff is kind of about sort of filling in holes and locking components into certain places, and that's kind of missing from these bigger movies.
Well, yeah, I mean that being said, I'd love to be in a big movie, you know.
But you see what I mean about the movies you've kind of done over the last 10 years.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. I don't know if it's a function of just, you know, getting older and wanting to deal with maybe just deeper kinds of things, you know, just going a little bit deeper with your work and being able, you know, you live life and you have experiences of whatever, sadness and life and birth and death and loss, and they are, for an actor, that's the you know, that's your glue. You know, that's your, those are your tools. You know, that's your palette and your brush. And you, and if it's sitting there, you know, and it's, and the colors are all there, you want to dip in and start to paint with it. So I think that's, you know, to find those kinds of movies is a function of both the fact that some of those kinds of things have been coming my way, and also of me just, you know, being older and wanting to use that part of me.
So I guess as you're talking about Dynano, I think that the fact is that was a movie that was idiosyncratic, that definitely came out as a product of the writer or director's sensibility, Barry Levinson's. But, you know, it found an audience. It's that thing that shows if you make something that really sort of comes from a very specific thing that you want to do or say, that it connects with a lot of people. And it can be like a much bigger sort of thing than people give it credit for as you're making it.
Sure, it can. There's always those great examples of movies that do connect in that kind of way. And, you know, Diner, I'll tell you, was kind of interesting in that the Diner came sort of on the heels of, I mean, I was in Animal House, which was the first big goofy, you know, kind of young person, you know,
bad taste comedy.
And then, you know, we had Porky's and on and on and on. Diner, I think, was originally sort of positioned as something kind of like there. You know, there was the penis and the popcorn, and there was, you know, a couple of other things that were kind of steering it towards one of those kinds of movies. I have a feeling that Barry almost got it financed with people kind of thinking that that was a kind of movie that he was making. And in the course of shooting the film, it became very clear that it was a much more personal, much more subtle, in some ways almost darker, you know, more human kind of film.
And an answer in some ways to a lot of those kinds of films, a response, in fact.
A response, right. And surprisingly, the studio wanted to shelve it once the movie was going to be released. They had no interest in it because they felt like it was just not funny. You know, where were the fart jokes? And you know, who cares about these guys? And it eventually, you know, found the light of day by critics actually screening the film and sort of putting pressure on the studio at the time to release it. So, you know, it really was, I think, a very, very personal film for Barry, and I think a great, you know, a great beginning to a great career.
And this film has to feel in a lot of ways similar to you, The Lover Boy, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, look, I mean, it's the story I wanted to tell, and I am amazed that we could get it done. You know, I mean, I'm always amazed that you can get anything done. You know, to actually get somebody to finance it and to shoot it and to get it out there. And, you know, I'm very excited that people are going to get a chance to see it.
I'm glad you came by to talk about it. Thanks.
Thanks, Elvis.
Our guest is Kevin Bacon. His second film as a director is Loverboy. Our technical director at KCRW is Bob Carlson, who's also the editor with assistance at Carnegie Recording Studios from Lashik Wojcik. Mary Bradley is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.